Thank you very much, and I appreciate the chance to actually be here with two of my heroes as well, as many other people in the audience who have been fabulous friends of ours for so long. My job is sort of, I feel like I'm, if you thought your job was bad in the middle, I feel a little bit squeezed at the end here. What I was going to do is go to the ground level and just tell you what's happened in Boston sort of granularly, which I think, is probably just an example of what Jim Withers has so nicely painted as in a broad stroke. But I love this picture. It's the oldest picture I have from Healthcare for the Homeless. It's when I started as this has been my full-time job since 1985. And this was the first, I finished my residency at Mass General along with Pat. I was in the ICU my last rotation. So I was a medical senior in charge of the ICU, which makes you feel pretty full of yourself because you think you can do everything. And my job that was June 30th, up until June 30th. And July 1st, I went down the street to Pine Street Inn to start working with this new Healthcare for the Homeless program that had been funded by Rob Wood Johnson. And I hope there's some nurses here, but anyway, I have an older sister who's a nurse, so I've been trained properly here. But I got into the shelter, thought they were going to be thrilled that I was going to be there, and the nurses sat me down, and gave me a really stern look. I'll never forget it. Barbara McGinnis was one of the nurses, saying, "Look, we've been taking care of homeless people for about 20 years out here in the shelters. Thank you very much. And we haven't had much help from doctors or the mainstream healthcare system." So they made me soak feet. My job for the first 3 months was soaking feet. Okay, and you have to remember, this is coming out of where you had to go a million miles an hour in residency, and you had to see a lot of people, and people were going to knock on the door if you weren't seeing five people. And the nurses said, "Nope, soak the feet." I couldn't have a stethoscope. I wasn't allowed to do anything except soak feet. And this man who I had seen many times in the emergency room at Mass General was one of my jobs. And I was soaking his feet, and I think about after a month or maybe 5 weeks, he looked down at me and he said, "I thought you were supposed to be a doctor." And I said, "I am, but I'm doing what the nurses tell me." He said, "What the hell are you doing soaking feet?" And I remember Barbara looking over and saying, "Yes, he's finally said something. You know, he finally talked to me." And a few weeks later, he came in. He said, "Doc, I'm having trouble sleeping. Can you give me something?" And I had known him, and in his chart, it used to say paranoid schizophrenia treatment resistant in his Mass General chart. And he let me give him a little bit of Haldol to help him sleep. And he came back a few nights later and said, "That really helped. Can you give me more, Doc?" And it was interesting. It was all of a sudden this guy asking for the treatment that we had thought he was resistant to. And then he got in a group home, and he stayed in the group home. After 22 years on the streets, he was in a group home until he died. I think about 8 years ago he died. But it was the lesson for me, it was the slowing down lesson. And as Barbara used to say, nothing changes in the world of homelessness unless you can take time to earn people's trust and be present. And I think that's been elegantly said by both Jim and Pat. This was Barbara. I remember her saying this. Boy, she used to read us a riot. If you're waiting for people to come to your clinic, you have lost the ball game. So I remember that being the theme of our thing. And in 1984, and I just wanted to share this with you because it was interesting, we were created by a coalition, as the Rob Wood Johnson Foundation programs all were, by a coalition of community stakeholders. And they had a very different view of the world than I certainly did coming out of an academic medical center. And I could tell you stories and stories about that. But this is what they came up with before we started. This was and it was 88 people at City Hall that hammered the mayor into saying, "This is what we want." And they wanted, notice this, continuity of care, and they added shelter and street, because they were very clear back in 1984 that there's different issues there. And they wanted to go from Shelton Street right through to the hospital. So they pushed us, as Pat was saying, to make sure we stayed part of the hospital, but we had to get out of our clinics and out into the street. It was an interesting model that the community came up with. They also insisted on teams because they thought continuity of care could not be done by one person. If you get sick or you leave, then the people you've been taking care of are left without anyone. So we had to work with teams of doctors, with nurse practitioners and physician assistants and caseworkers, et cetera, right from the beginning. And then the last thing, I put this up because it's the first time I'd ever seen the word respite care. The community wanted that respite care, which Pat described a little bit ago. So what happened is we went out that first year, 1985, we started going out and doing clinics in the shelters, almost all of the major adult shelters. And during that winter, we started noticing that people were dying outside. We didn't know what to do. And the state very nicely gave the Department of Public Health the money to fund a van that went out at nighttime to try to reach out to the street people. So this would be in the fall of 1986. And I remember, this is it, it's Pine Street Inn, which is this fabulous shelter in Boston. It's the oldest and largest shelter in New England. And they now, every night of the year, and they have since 1986, they just had their 25th anniversary or something like that, they go out from 9 at night till 5 in the morning to reach out to the street folks. And those are the people that don't come in to the things, as Pat been saying. These are my heroes in the world. These are the people that drive the van. They're out every night. Most of them have been through homelessness many times. Most are in recovery or still struggling, but they are phenomenal. They never judge. They're out there every night, and they just do their job. And they're paid. This is not a volunteer job. They're paid to do it. And the van was made deliberately not medical. It was made something that would bring soup and sandwiches and blankets and clothing so that the things that people outside would need. So if you ever want to come and ride in the van with us, you'll notice all night long cell phones are ringing saying, where the hell are you? Bring me a blanket. You know, it's become what everybody on the street looks for. And it turns out to be the most effective medical model that I know. Okay, and they do this. It's all the stuff you would know. This is a man who just lives in Copley Square, has lived there for years and years and years. Doesn't matter what the weather is. People that will fall just down on benches. But one of the things I wanted to share with you that also is a part of, I think, street medicine that I think you heard Jim underscore really clearly, is that when we were going out on the van, I can remember we would wake people up in the middle of a park or under a bridge at, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock, and ask them, are they doing okay? And somebody one night gave me a hard time. I remember this was 1987 or 88. Gave me a hard time about, you know, how would you like your doctor showing up in your bedroom at 2 a.m. and saying, how you doing? And I panicked because, you know, it's pretty damn invasive. And then I started to think, how should you do a model of outside? You know, how can you not be violating somebody's privacy? So we have also, by dictum from our that community board that put us together, this is our consumer advisory board. Six of those people are actually on our board of directors. And they are all people who, except for two community people there, they're all people who are either homeless now or using our services. Several of them also live on the streets. And it's really different. So they're not only a board that we can go to for advice, but then six of them sit on our board of directors, which means they're basically our bosses, which is very different from my life in the hospital. But anyway, what we went to them and said, hey, I feel badly. What should we do about this? And they gathered the street folks, and they had a forum. We couldn't go to it. They had a three-hour session about how people wanted to be cared for. And at the end of that, they came out and said, you know, and I was actually so grateful. They talked it over and they said, please, if we're out there, wake us up. We need you to just check on us. But then they came back with, you know, the usual retort, nothing's ever free. And they were really pissed off because we used to come with these flashlights looking for people under the bridge. And they said, take those damn flashlights and shine them on your face when you're out there. So when you think about that, it's a key tenet of street medicine. The light should be on you so they know who you are, not on them so they don't know who's good. So anyway, that helped us through that. It was really fabulous. And then we had several outbreaks of deaths on the streets, and we realized just going out at nighttime wasn't really quite enough. So in the late 90s and early 2000s, we started doing literally daytime street rounds to match the nighttime street rounds. And this I chose because Pat's in the middle of this. Pat worked with us on our street team for 6 or 7 years. He was also, when he was a resident, Mass General, helped us out. And Jill Roncarotti, who's sitting in the back there, was our physician assistant, is also in that picture. So I thought I'd pick on you both here. But these were rounds. It started at Finagle Bagel because you couldn't do rounds, morning rounds, in the hospital because nobody would be there. But at Finagle Bagel, the folks could come in and you could start the day and make a plan. And after rounds, all I know is I remember that Jill was on the phone there trying to get a detox bed for Tim, who's sitting there in the right, in the foreground. And then everybody heads out, and it's kind of a ritual to where people are outside during the day. And I'm sorry about this picture, which includes everybody, but I wanted to emphasize that one of the joys of street medicine, as you move along, you realize you can't do it unless you're multidisciplinary. So you're only as good as the team you're with. So I mean, that's in the standing up in the red shirt is Kendall, who's an LICSW. Eileen is our psychiatrist in the red hair, and then I would be with Pat and or Jill. You know, we'd have medicine and mental health folks together as well as the support services, and. You know, and typically I love this picture because we were seeing those three people who live on the common, all of whom were dead within about 6 months of the time we took that picture. This is Jill and our nurse, Cheryl, just trying to convince somebody to go into detox. And this is the picture I showed this morning because I can't not show it, but it's very cool to witness somebody who's really struggling with a medical and a mental health illness to be able to sit and have a cup of coffee at McDonald's and talk to both their internist and their psychiatrist about plans for making medicine. And I could give you the details of what was going on then, but you get the picture. This is integrated care, the way I think I would like my doc and docs to be. Cheryl looking at somebody under the bridge. Now, here is a question that came up a long time ago, and I have to thank our physician assistants and nurse practitioners about this. I was trying to figure out, do you do episodic care when you're outside? And this is going to come up if you do street medicine. You know, you're doing dressing changes and episodic care. But how do you incorporate continuity of care? And I think you've heard that theme throughout today. And one of the things we realized that we got challenged to is, what do you do in a clinic office that can't be done outside? And if you really look at your time, it's really very little that you couldn't do outside if you really imagine stuff a little bit. I was resistant to this at first, but I got totally convinced by Jill and Denny, who's one of our nurse practitioners, that we can do it. And this is like flu shot season. We'll try as hard as we can to get everybody a flu shot. We can get them pneumovaxes. You know, the stuff that is primary care quality indicators, if you start thinking of this as a chance to do continuity of care, it actually works pretty well. The other thing that we had to learn is, what's the triage mechanism when you're out there? Because, you know, you're walking outside. If you, everybody, you know, we'll see 30 people that look like that in a day, and who's sick and who's not sick? You know, and who do you walk by and say is just drunk and sleeping or not? And one of the things that came up that I'm sort of almost embarrassed, and this is the oldest picture I have of these things, this is what we carry now, rather than, I shouldn't say now, for years now we've carried this, rather than we used to have lots of different equipment and we boiled it down to this. I like this picture because it's the oldest BlackBerry I can remember. That's version one, if any of you are still around for that. But the stethoscope is kind of there as an archaic instrument, but we do use it, okay? But there's a wrist blood pressure cuff. Actually, if I go to the next one, this is a better picture. So we use a wrist blood pressure cuff, which, you know, you can poo-poo a little bit. It's not great, you know, it's not the best, but you know what? It's really bad when it's very low, when your pressure is very low or very high. It's not as accurate. But we don't really care. If it's going to be really low or really high, we're worried. Okay? If it's in the normal range, that's usually pretty accurate. And then this little finger stick pulse ox is really fabulous. You put it on somebody's finger, you know what their oxygen saturation rate is in about seconds. Okay? And you just put it on their fingertip. Also, we'll give you your pulse at the time. And then the other one is just an ear thermometer. Okay? And all of those things, by the way, I was always told those were not good. But in street medicine, they are invaluable. So if you go back to this man whose name is Richie, who we knew really well, he's sleeping at a little park, and with just sort of waking, you know, saying, Richie, can we talk to you? And he'll say, okay. And we could get his blood pressure, his pulse, his respiratory rate, his temperature, and if we needed, and his oxygen saturation rate, and even if we needed to, we could get a finger stick sugar. So if you think like emergency room stuff, that's a pretty damn good triage mechanism, and you can do that without taking any clothes off. Okay, so just think of that if you're going to do street medicine. Turned out in this particular case, his pulse ox was down in the low 80s. It should be up, for those of you not clinicians, up in the 90s. And he had a pneumonia. We knew he was sick. But you could do that by sort of relatively reasonable triage. The other thing that we now carry, which is now several years, is a little camera. And I didn't know much about telemedicine because it sounds pretty fancy and it sounds like it's like third world country stuff. But it's invaluable on the street. We have this wonderful dermatologist named Ernesto Gonzalez, who is back at Mass General, and we can take a picture of this, of a rash like this, and email it directly to him, and usually within minutes, if not hours, he's going to give you the answer. And it turns out dermatologists can make an accurate diagnosis 95% of the time from a good picture, okay? And try to go to see a dermatologist. It takes you months to get there, okay? So this is really interesting. So this guy had been in 5 emergency rooms. He had been treated for scabies on most occasions. On his back, it looks a little bit like Norwegian scabies, if any of you have ever seen that or care about it. But it turns out he's got this stuff up around his neck that didn't make any sense. In fact, this is a picture of these things on his neck. So we sent this to Ernesto because we were confused. And we had all trained under Ernesto, so he sent back this kind of harumph type of email. He said, you know, you've seen this many times. Does anybody know what this is? Did you? It turns out to be nummular psoriasis, and it's treated with a steroid cream, and you could fix it within a week, where he had been in 5 emergency rooms and not been diagnosed. So we were, like, very proud of ourselves and now carry a little camera and email. In fact, Mass General has now given us a special camera. We take the picture, and it goes directly to the dermatology resident on call, which is really very cool. Now, here's the struggle that I would share with you, at least in Boston. As we got out to see people and we're trying to do continuity of care, many people, we could do a lot of stuff outside, but many people were just too sick to really get everything done. So we needed a place inside to see them. We tried to do it at Boston Medical Center, which is kind of the hospital that sees most of the homeless people and poor, but it turns out that geographically, the shelters are down by Boston Medical Center, and that's where the vast majority of homeless people go. But the street folks live around Mass General Hospital. So we ended up convincing the hospital, and that was an interesting discussion, as you can imagine, to have a street clinic. Every Thursday, we have a clinic there Monday through Friday for homeless folks, but the street folks are, you know, a decidedly different, to the hospital's view anyway, group. So we have a Thursday clinic that both Pat and Jill started, was there in the beginning, and Pat has worked with us for many years, and I think it's still the only one in the country, but it's really interesting. This is Marianne, who's our nurse doing triage and the hospital gives us coffee and donuts. We have a special little waiting room. And I love this picture, and I don't have a pointer that I can use very easily, but I love it because after we took it, we realized that this guy named Michael is sleeping under the table, if you see him off on the left there. So you get the flavor for what the clinic is like. And we thought at first that this would be very slow, sleepy kind of clinic. And we are now seeing at least the number of people who showed up at clinic. Like last week, it was 96 people came for the Thursday clinic. And we have our two exam rooms upstairs, which is pretty tight. But many people come just to be, you know, have their, you know, there's lots of different things you can do. So we have most of our team there on our days. And it's fun. It's where we can have students. I love this picture because it's several of our students and patients who are together. And actually, in that picture, there is a Rhodes Scholar and two Harvard Medical students now. So we got some really striking students who come and will actually energize our lives in a great way. And then this is our psychiatrist, whose name is Jim Bonner, and he is funded entirely by Mass General Hospital because they've now made an investment, and I would urge you to get to your hospitals because there's a good investment to be made in getting stuff done on the street rather than the emergency room. And we've got 5 years of salary for him, but he doesn't have a room, so he sees people right there in the cafeteria. And this is another interesting street medicine issue about is that, you know, it's not very confidential, but it's a place where people will go because they don't feel frightened. There's nothing that says psychiatry, mental health, anything like that. And Jim will see somebody for a minute or 2 minutes, or people can just stop by and say, I got a question. And he's a pretty seasoned psychiatrist who's run lots of mental health teams, run PAC teams before. And he's now a convert. He believes this is probably the most effective way to get in touch and engage people. So he also now has a room upstairs in psychiatry if he wants to bring people up for privacy. Just to give you a hint of a continuity. Pat's smiling here because these are two of our very favorite people. But I think as we've gone along, the establishing of street medicine relies a lot on how do you assure continuity. You want to engage people and be sure that they're in a system. And this is Brad, who's standing up, who's he's a Green, at least he told us. He was a veteran. Was a Green Beret in Vietnam, came back and something happened and he ended up on the streets. And this is his partner, Charles, who, and this picture was taken, I'm trying to figure out, like 2 years ago now, in the clinic at Mass General. And they were kind of a street couple. And Charles always was near and dear to me because when I first started, we didn't have any AIDS in the homeless community. And the first month I was working in 1985, the epidemic began to hit the poor and homeless communities. And Charles was the first person I took care of who was a long-term non-progressor. Everybody else was dying. He didn't get sick. Nothing happened. And he ended up being that way for years and years and years. In fact, we often questioned whether he really had HIV, and I remember repeating it so that he did. And then about 2 years ago, his CD4 count suddenly started to drop. But because he had been maintaining his immune system by his diet, he refused to take the medicines we were trying to get him to take, which would have been life-preserving at least. And he said, no, I'm going to tough it out. And we had known him for years, and we could not convince him. And so not long after that picture, he came in with pneumocystis pneumonia and died in the ICU. It was really horrifying for us because we had known him. But it was on his terms, just so you know. Now, Brad, who had been his partner for so long, not long after that began to lose a lot of weight. We thought he was grieving. To make a very long story short, turns out we finally got him in for a chest x-ray. He had a huge lung cancer that was metastatic to his spine and his brain. And Brad was dead within months of the time Charles had died. And I don't know if I've shown Pat this, but I was looking through my files, and this is a picture I took of the two of them in 1986, okay, at Long Island Shelter when they got married, all right? And you have to understand, getting married in those days was not, even in Massachusetts, not legal. And in the shelter, it's not usually, politics are all over the place in the shelter. You have to be very gutsy to be a Green Beret veteran from Vietnam getting married in the shelter to Charles. But I just remember they stuck together for 27 years. It's a really stunning story. And even though it ended sort of sadly, they did it on their terms. It was really pretty amazing. So let me show you what let me end by saying what has happened now. You know, you think you've done the right thing, and then every time we look at our outcomes and death and everything else, you realize that this is not enough by any means. And it's really all about going to the next level. And the next level, I'm sure, is going to force everybody to go to the next level. But housing seems to be at least the most important thing we've got right now. Although I fear, as Pat hinted, that we have to also provide the supportive services for folks like this once they're in housing, and I am worried to death that we're not going to support that enough. But anyway, this is our first, I think, if Jill can correct me, I think this was our very first person who we put into housing through the Housing First program in 2005. And it's a guy we love, and his name is Billy. He would just fall asleep, but this was his house. We moved him in. I remember he was so thrilled. He's 62 years old or 61 years old, never had his own place. Moved in, had his name on a door, went shopping. We realized we had a big problem that, although I thought this was pretty reasonable, but I got assured by everybody else on the team this was not good. The added problem was he also had very bad heart failure, and this is about as bad a sodium load as you can give somebody. It took days to get these two essential IDs. We had no idea it was going to take so long. And then the question was, how do you maintain this man who had been in and out of the emergency room nonstop with sort of basically not able to adhere to his blood pressure and heart medications? And he was drinking. And this is Jill. Ended up going to visit him probably 4 and 5 times a week when we first moved him in, trying to get him to take his medications. And Jill did this kind of remarkable job, along with the housing worker that was on our team as well. And here he is taking now all of his medications, as he's supposed to. He doesn't read or write, by the way, which is another major issue. He's taking them all as he's supposed to. The compromise for him, or not the compromise, but the other thing was he said, he takes it with his vodka. And so we had to sit there and realize this is a harm reduction picture, okay? So he was delightful. He finally did it, but nope, I'm not interested in stopping drinking now. Interestingly, though, he was very happy in his house, and he did not go back to the emergency room at all, okay, once he got into housing. And I could tell you the rest of the story. It turned out that he ended up, having an arrhythmia and dying at home. We went home to see him one day, and he was dead on the floor, which is one of the things, if any of you are working in housing, is kind of the dreaded outcome you go for. However, it's a very, let me leave that alone. I'll tell you what is going on. So we have, as a team now, just started escalating the number of home visits. So we have, as a practice, if you think of us as a practice, within a Healthcare for the Homeless program, our street team cares for somewhere about 500 active people, probably about 800 people in total, all of whom meet that kind of hardcore definition of they've lived 6 months consecutively on the streets or more. And now more and more of them getting into housing. They used to always be at the bottom of the list, as all you know. Now they've gone to the top of the list. And the number of housing visits we've done has just escalated each year. The interesting thing is you can do all these things at home now, all the shots and everything else at home. We always go as this is Jim, our psychiatrist, who's with Suzanne, our nurse practitioner. So we always go with a medical and a mental health or behavioral health person as a team. We go in twos because you don't want to go alone to this. So you can still integrate care in very unusual ways there. And the problem for us in Boston is we have no buildings where you can sit 20 or 30 or 40 or 80 people. They're all scattered sites, single-bedroom apartments, so the challenge of where you go each day gets a little bit nasty. You can see the spread. We used to be able to walk outside on the street and see 15 or 20 people at Copley Square, another 15 or 20 at South Station. Now it's all scattered. And just to give you a couple quick stories to end with, this is near Boston Garden, and there was two people found. This is John standing up. He was found right in that spot on a very cold January morning, and he was brought in along with Sam was sitting down to Mass General's emergency room. It was January 17th. I remember this. And their body temperatures, one was 70 and one was 72, which is in the old days was not really compatible with being alive. And they both got shunted up to the cardiac surgery suite, and they had their body warmed through the heart-lung machine. And they both survived. This picture was taken after that happened. Neither one had any noticeable neurological sequelae, which was very, very unusual. And then John, the one who's top, was got into housing soon after that. He was one of our early Housing First people, and he was thrilled. He had lived on the streets for some 20-some years. He's in housing. He looks amazing. This is his housing worker who's on the team, worked for Home Start. So we partner with housing agencies. We don't do the housing ourselves. But then, that was only the beginning. We used to think, wow, he's in there now, but remember, there's now a ton of work to be done. And this is John, who, as his cirrhosis progressed and his other medical problems, this is a few days before he actually died. But he stayed in housing. He's still in housing here. He ended up dying in the ICU because it turned out there was a sudden bad thing going on. But the management of his care all while he was going through that is a lot like, if any of you do palliative care, is a lot like palliative care. It's very intense. It requires a lot of support in many, many ways. And that's what's happening as we get people into housing. So instead of the work that seemed intense on the street getting a little less when they get into housing, I would submit for many people, you're asking for more and more of your staff to do that. This is I don't know if I've shown you this, Pat, but I wanted to put this, but this is Leroy, who is the guy sleeping outside. He disappeared from us. We knew him for years and years, and this is his picture. He loved this picture. He asked me to take it because he thinks he looks like Kris Kristofferson. And his claim to fame was that when Kristofferson was playing in Springfield, Massachusetts one time, he snuck out there, snuck in, and actually got on stage, and Kristofferson was so stunned, he actually let him play a duet with him. And this was his story, okay? And he did it. But anyway, Leroy disappeared. He used to call us all the time and ask what was going on. He disappeared. We hadn't seen him for 4 years. And then he came into the clinic at Mass General last year, just last Halloween, as a matter of fact, so just about a year ago now. And he came in. We hadn't seen him. He'd been 4 years in jail. And he came out, you know, and it, just like everything, we didn't know where he was. Nobody told us when he came out. We didn't know anything had happened. And he had lost half his body weight. So he came up, and we're looking at him, and this is Sinead, our nurse in the clinic, and this was, he just came in, he said, "Doc, you know, something's going wrong. I can't swallow. I can't do anything." He had a huge esophageal cancer. It was not operable, but he was able to stay with his wife, and this is a picture we took when we got him home and did all the hospice care at home, and even though this looks like someone who died, it's a mortality in housing, he decided to die the way he wanted to. You know, he had his home, he was with his ex-wife. It turns out there are many kids living in this one room. It was a very, very interesting situation. But his wife had decorated the room for Halloween. This was his brother. He hadn't seen in a long time. And this was a picture she asked me to take with Leroy the day before he actually died. And so I was thinking about the privilege of caring for him when he used to sleep outside, you know, being able to bring him through the specialty care that he needed at Mass General, and he came to us, and then be able to follow him at home was pretty profound. And I think that's the... You know, if I were to end here, I'd say that's what I think we're all looking to do if we can. It certainly makes the job of being a member of a healthcare team or a medical home team really exciting and really wonderful, but also very profound in many ways. So I would end by telling you all that what Jim said in the beginning and Pat emphasized is this. I think street medicine, caring for people on the street, is a tiny little bit of what the world is. But those are the folks who I think, as I've liked to say for years, really will show us the weaknesses in our healthcare system before anyone else will show it to us. And if you can address how to care for them, I think we have a lot to tell the mainstream healthcare system. And making sure street medicine stays mainstream and not outstream is really the key. But anyway, thank you very much for your time, and let me thank you.